The Burial of the Rats. Leaving Paris by the Orleans Road, across the Enceinte, and turning to the right, you find yourself in a somewhat wild and not at all savoury district. Right and left, before and behind, on every side, rise great heaps of dust and waste, accumulated by the process of time. Paris has its night as well as its day life, and the sojourner who enters his hotel in the Rue de Rivoli or the Rue Saint-Honoré late at night, or leaves it early in the morning, can guess, in coming near Montrouge, if he has not done so already, the purpose of those great wagons that look like boilers on wheels which he finds halting everywhere as he passes. Every city has its peculiar institutions created out of its own needs, and one of the most notable institutions of Paris is its rag-picking population. In the early morning, and Parisian life commences at an early hour, may be seen in most streets, standing on the pathway opposite every court and alley, and between every few houses, as still in some American cities, even in parts of New York, large wooden boxes, into which the domestics or tenement holders empty the accumulated dust of the past day. Round these boxes gather and pass on, when the work is done, to fresh fields of labour and pastures new, squalid, hungry-looking men and women, the implements of whose craft consist of a coarse bag or basket slung over the shoulder, and a little rake with which they turn over and probe and examine in the minutest manner the dustbins. They pick up and deposit in their baskets, by aid of their rakes, whatever they may find, with the same facility as a Chinaman uses his chopsticks. Paris is a city of centralization, and centralization and classification are closely allied. In the early times, when centralization is becoming a fact, its forerunner is classification. All things which are similar or analogous become grouped together, and from the grouping of groups rises one whole or central point. We see radiating many long arms with innumerable tentaculi, and in the centre rises a gigantic head with a comprehensive brain and keen eyes to look on every side, and ears sensitive to hear, and a voracious mouth to swallow. Other cities resemble all the birds and beasts and fishes whose appetites and digestions are normal. Paris alone is the analogical apotheosis of the octopus. Product of centralization carried to an ad absurdum, it fairly represents the devilfish. And in no respects is the resemblance more curious than in the similarity of the digestive apparatus. Those intelligent tourists who, having surrendered their individuality into the hands of Messrs. Cook or Gaze, do Paris in 3 days, are often puzzled to know how it is that the dinner which in London, which costs 6 shillings, can be had for 3 francs in a café in the Palais Royal. They need have no more wonder if they will but consider the classification which is a theoretic speciality of Parisian life, and adopt all round the fact from which the chiffonnier has his genesis. The Paris of 1850 was not like the Paris of today, and those who see the Paris of Napoleon and Baron Haussmann can hardly realise the existence of the state of things 45 years ago. Amongst other things, however, which have not changed, are those districts where the waste is gathered. Dust is dust all the world over, in every age, and the family likeness of dust heaps is perfect. The traveller, therefore, who visits the environs of Montrouge can go back in fancy, without difficulty, to the year 1850. In this year, I was making a prolonged stay in Paris. I was very much in love with a young lady who, though she returned my passion, so far yielded to the wishes of her parents that she had promised not to see me or to correspond with me for a year. I, too, had been compelled to accede to these conditions under a vague hope of parental approval. During the term of probation, I had promised to remain out of the country and not to write to my dear one until the expiration of the year. Naturally, the time went heavily with me. There was not one of my own family or circle who could tell me of Alice, and none of her own folk had, I am sorry to say, sufficient generosity to send me even an occasional word of comfort regarding her health and well-being. I spent 6 months wandering about Europe, but as I could find no satisfactory distraction in travel, I determined to come to Paris, where at least I would be within easy hail of London in case any good fortune should call me thither before the appointed time. That hope deferred maketh the heart sick was never better exemplified than in my case. For in addition to the perpetual longing to see the face I loved, there was always with me a harrowing anxiety lest some accident should prevent me showing Alice in due time that I had, throughout the long period of probation, been faithful to her trust and my own love. Thus every adventure which I undertook had a fierce pleasure of its own, for it was fraught with possible consequences greater than it would have ordinarily borne. Like all travellers, I exhausted the places of most interest in the first month of my stay, and was driven in the second month to look for amusement whithersoever I might. Having made sundry journeys to the better-known suburbs, I began to see that there was a terra incognita, in so far as the guidebook was concerned, in the social wilderness lying between these attractive points. Accordingly, I began to systematize my researches, and each day took up the thread of my exploration at the place where I had on the previous day dropped it. In the process of time, my wanderings led me near Montrouge, and I saw that hereabouts lay the ultima thule of social exploration, a country as little known as that round the source of the White Nile.